Okay, so welcome to the Arcady Group Thinkers podcast. I'm your host, Justin McCord. With me is B-side Ronnie. I called you that at the end of our interview, B-side Ronnie. And we're fresh off of this discussion. And so there's a lot of things percolating as we think about our guest, old Mandolin Dave. While I'm just doling out extremely specific nicknames. Tell us about Mandolin Dave, Ronnie.
So our guest, is Dave Raley. He's the founder of Imago Consulting. Super excited. He's got a new book coming out, I believe, tomorrow for those who are listening. It's called The Rise of Sustainable Giving. There's Justin holding it up for those watching on video. He also hosts a podcast, co-hosts Purpose and Profit podcast. And Dave is a pioneer in the digital space for nonprofits. He worked almost two decades at an agency and really got the digital fundraising part of it up and running from the start. So, I mean, just tremendous background and lots of knowledge. And he shares a lot of this in the conversation. And one of the parts that stuck out for me, though, was when I asked him about this gap he has between, he doesn't like to be the first to try something and make the mistakes. He likes to follow after that. But then he also, every 2 years, kind of has noticed that he gets an itch to try something new. So this balance of trying new things, but not wanting to be the first to make the mistakes, is that part was fascinating to me.
Dave is in the nonprofit multiverse. Dave is a version of Jared Schrimmer in a way, and just in terms of having been a part of the multiple generations of digital fundraising, and I love that we kind of pull that apart and talk through that as a part of this conversation. And I just think it's so exciting to see folks like Dave taking a step of launching something like this, this being the book, as well as with his work with Imago. And so here's Mandolin Dave, Dave Raley of Imago Consulting on the Arcady Group Thinkers podcast. Dave, what's it like to be a Disney adult?
So good. It's just like, there's these cultures, like in East Asia, I feel like it's like so okay to just wear your heart on your sleeve, and geek out. So I feel like as an American, as a, conservative, person, like just to be able to just be out there with my Disney appreciation, it just feels good.
Where does that come from? Or where did it originate?
I was born and raised in Southern California. So I definitely had a bit of the, in fact, my parents would take me every year to this convention, and it was in Anaheim, California. And across the street from the Anaheim Convention Center, Justin, was this place called Disneyland. We did not have the money to go into Disneyland. I definitely grew up by most definitions poor. I mean, we were homeless at times, candidly, as a kid. But I remember looking over the fence at Disneyland and just being like, that place is awesome. My mom would take me to the Disneyland Hotel, which is like, might as well have been Disneyland to me. And I was like, so cool. Fast forward, 40 years, got two little girls. We live in the Pacific Northwest now. So it's kind of that, distance makes the heart grow fonder type of situation. So we love it. We love it.
But there's somewhere in between little Dave and older Dave. There's a line there of how it either stayed relevant in your life or came back into your life.
So good. Came back. I mean, I was candidly in college. We lived in LA, so we were like just down the freeway from Disney, and it was like, we went once, I think, in 4 years, lived the early adulting years, and it was, candidly, it was kids and then nostalgia, right? When you take your two-year-old and they're walking down Main Street in a Tinkerbell outfit, and the like world is theirs, you know, you're just like, okay, sign me up. How much is this?
Yeah. Yeah. I've got the pictures of taking the 3-year-old, right? Mm-hmm. Same thing. Asleep in the stroller wearing the Aurora dress. So like all the ruffles are crumpled over. And
quintessential.
I've got the boy version of, I think, 3 and 5-year-old with lightsabers on the hotel bed.
Yeah. It's like the Avengers, you know, Star Wars. It
taps into something. Okay. So let's go back to your upbringing. And so since you didn't want to be a Disney character, which was what I assumed, that you just wanted to be Peter Pan when you grew up, as far back as you can remember, what was it that you wanted to get into? What did you want to be when you grew up?
Oh, man. So I had friends that were like, I'm going to be a fighter pilot. I'm going to be a firefighter. And for whatever reason, when I was young, it was like, okay, like good for you. You know, that wasn't super attractive to me. The earliest that I can remember, though, where I kind of discovered a passion was probably 8th grade. And it was 8th grade computer class, guys. I'm old enough now. I'm a geriatric millennial, by the way. Some more and more people are familiar with that. That the internet was like this newfangled thing. And I coded my first website, and I was like, it was, by the way, Happy Gilmore. You know that movie?
Yeah.
Class. You're among friends here.
Okay. I still don't know how I did this, but I was able to like digitize, because this is like VHS days, guys, you know? So I was able to digitize my favorite clips from Happy Gilmore, and built an entire like fan site for Happy Gilmore. And I was just like, number one, computers are awesome. This internet thing is so cool. And then it was later in life that I was like, actually, the internet is like this really cool business opportunity. And so that was, you know, in college was like, I went to college to go be an IT web person. And then I had to take these like marketing and business classes. And I was like, wait a second. Like, one, I'm not like, I like people. I can't code all day. and so I'm going to be of limited use when it comes to that. And so for me, it was like this beautiful combination of like, yeah, the internet is a super cool thing. But the reality is I love business. I love marketing. I love just that life and the people that it affords me to meet.
Where did longboarding come into play?
Man,
how did that get in there? Deep cut.
I don't know. Is this a video podcast, by the way?
Yeah.
All right. I'll show you, because I have these sitting just off camera. Yeah. So when I was in college, I got into longboarding, because that's, you know, Southern California school, easy transportation around campus. I actually bought a longboard from my roommate, like an old, you know, dinged up longboard. And I was like, this is super cool. Learned how to longboard, design my own board, because that's just, you know, who I am. And I, you know, like spray painted it and had like custom stickers made for it and all this kind of stuff. Well, fast forward, a couple of classmates and I had to basically design a business plan for, you know, a class. And it was for this idea of a concept called Poncho Longboard Company. And we got to the end of the project and we were like, this is legit. Like, this is super cool. What if we actually did this? So we launched Poncho Longboards. And there were 3 of us. At our height, we were in 7 different states and like, you know, like doing it for real. Like, I remember we made boards at first by hand, literally fiberglass and resin, like plywood, and not recommended, by the way. And I told the guys after, I think, a year of doing that, guys, if we're not going to do this legit, like, I'm out. As much as I like you, I don't want to go, you know, deal with these chemicals all day. And so we got some funding and actually launched it. So I always have this hiding off camera. So I think you guys are the first to see it. But since you asked the question,
we love a good prop. I kind of want him to ride it.
These are still, well, these are just decks, but these are just, and they're still wrapped up, but you can see them. So one of our series we called the East West series. So we had like a little yin and yang option. So This is our west. This is our east board. Sorry. Seems pretty obvious. Uh-huh. And then our west.
It's awesome. Those are nice looking.
Thank you, sir. Yeah.
That's fantastic.
I still ride.
Whatever happened? Whatever happened up to the company?
You know, I always loved the entrepreneurship thing. Basically, I was my business partner, founder Joe was basically the creative genius. Like he did all these designs. Like it was his concept. He was just such the quintessential artist. The other guy, Eric, was like the quintessential sales guy, musician, could talk to anybody about anything, like just people person to the core. And then I was literally everything else. So accounting, sales or finance, marketing, legal. And I learned so much, but I was like, at the end of the day, it's like, I'm not a skater dude. Like I don't, you know, so this is not a lifelong passion. And it was candidly graduating school and looking for quote unquote, a real job, and realizing, and that was the point in time I realized that you could actually like get paid to work for nonprofits. Did you know, guys, that you can get paid as a professional career working with nonprofits?
Heard about that. I've heard about that.
Rumors. I've heard rumors.
How to, okay. So, but you got to tie together. If I remember right, your wife's from the Pacific Northwest. And so that was a little bit of the pull from Southern California.
Yes. So my wife's from Oregon. Yep. Good memory. I'm originally from basically Palm Springs, Palm Desert, the Inland Empire, as we call it in California. And by the way, Coachella wasn't cool when I lived there. It was only cool later.
Okay. Can you and I longboard at Coachella soon?
Yeah, we totally can. Okay, let's do it. So just in school in LA, was engaged to be married. My wife and I were like, neither of us wanted to stay in the broader Los Angeles, you know, concrete jungle. And so she didn't want to move to Palm Springs. And I was like, that's fine. I don't want to move to Oregon. And so we compromised and said, what is Seattle? What if we try Seattle? Like, seems like a cool vibe. And, just started looking for work from there. And that was literally 20 years ago this year.
How did you find or figure out that you can have a profession working with nonprofits once you got to, you know, the Seattle area?
So I was basically senior, just looking around. I figured if I'm going to move to another city, I need to basically just find the big companies in that city. So I looked at Microsoft, at the time, Costco, Washington Mutual Bank, by the way, Amazon, Facebook, Google, all those that are big major employers in the area, those were not really a thing. And so I was just trying to, you know, look for work. In fact, had some really good conversations with the heads of recruiting at Washington Mutual Bank. And I thought, ooh, work in the big shiny building downtown. Like, I don't know that I care about banking, but you know, they were at the time, they were like the cool bank, which by the way, didn't work out a couple of years later when they went bankrupt. So I'm glad that didn't work out. But because of that, I had looked through the alumni directory and there was a guy in banking in a place called Bainbridge Island, Washington, which sounded very exotic. So I went and hung out with him, and he basically told me about a friend of his that ended up being the executive creative director at this agency called Masterworks. And I was like, what's Masterworks? Oh, it's an advertising agency that works for faith-based nonprofit organizations. And at that point, I was like, wait a second. I'm graduating with a dual degree in marketing business and this information technology web stuff. Like, you mean I could like literally work at a quote-unquote agency that actually works with nonprofits? And that was like slam dunk. Like, I had job offers at a general contracting firm to be their director of marketing. The Washington Mutual thing basically fell through. There was one other company I was talking to, but it was like, oh no, like I want to go work for the agency that works for charities. Like that is such a cool thing. Like it just blew my mind.
So at the time you're starting that and you're thinking about websites and digital, I mean, that was pretty much in its infancy, or maybe even Ronnie, this still is, in the womb.
Listen, he's pre-infancy. He's a pioneer.
Let's be honest. My first day on the job, you guys will appreciate this. I had an office, which was only because they didn't have enough cubes for project managers. So I ended up in an office because that was the only space they had for me. And the company was growing. And the lead project manager basically walked in with literally, I'm not kidding, like 3 feet thick worth of binders. Each binder was 6 to 12 inches thick. And I was like, I've never seen a binder. Like, I just graduated school. I've never seen binders this thick. And they were all, and she said, look through these. Like, this was my first day on the job. It was all direct mail samples. And I was like, they never taught me this in marketing school. Like, what is this direct mail stuff? And at first I was like, okay, holy crap, what have I done? Like, because all I had learned in school was obviously web, but also, you know, the four P's of marketing and basically what I now understood as general advertising or, you know, brand advertising, right? I did not know candidly that direct marketing, period, was a thing until literally that first day on the job. And I was like, wait a second. So I actually ended up cutting my professional teeth on what we would call, you know, traditional fundraising, you know, radio, telemarketing, you know, direct mail, but it was unintentional. It was just like, oh man, I want to work and do this marketing thing for charities. It wasn't until a couple years later that it was like, hey guys, so the internet seems to really be changing things. Does anybody here know somebody that knows something about the internet? Oh, Dave, you know, ask Dave. He knows.
Ronnie, what you don't realize is that for all accounts, Dave is like the Tom from MySpace for faith-oriented causes.
That was the like nicest version of that metaphor that you could have come up with. I used to call myself the grandfather of digital at the agency because, of course, I ended up leading and building our digital team for a dozen years. And so by the time I stopped basically being responsible for that team, it was three generations of digital. Doesn't mean, you know, I still don't think of myself as a digital person, but it's just, yeah, it's a wild difference between back then and today.
There's a, you know, you spend 18 years at the agency and that's a lot of lifetimes, not just generations of digital, but that's a lot of lifetimes. And it's a lot of lifetimes working in nonprofit on top of, you know, zooming in on the direct marketing space and growing digital for so many faith forward causes and awesome organizations that you have had a chance to work with. Talk a little bit about the people that kept you grounded, and kept you sane, and that sewed into you during that tenure.
Man, great question. I learned a phrase or a term, I guess, years and years ago. I think it was a Seth Godin post, and he wrote an article on the difference between heroes and mentors. And one of the things he talked about was you can have heroes in your life that you may actually never meet, right? You've read their stuff, you've been exposed to their ideas, you appreciate something about them, and they can be a hero to you and you can learn. And then he talked about the difference between that and mentors, which are people that are actually in your life. And I've been blessed to really have both. Hopefully everybody has both. But for me, it's been this combination of people that I just candidly look up to and just try to, you know, I've never felt like there's like one mentor or hero that's like, oh, I just want to be like them. But I have always admired aspects of different individuals, if that makes sense. And so for me professionally, there are really several individuals that would be much more in the mentor category. So Steve Woodworth is the, you know, CEO of Masterworks, and he worked for the guy for 18 years. And I actually just wrote a recent post on crossing the 1,000,000 mile mark with travel, which, by the way, Justin was probably like, oh, I hit that years ago. But
every other Tuesday.
Yeah, I know. But one of the things I said was one of the lessons I learned, you know, I've learned over travel is just to set what's an acceptable, you know, travel schedule for you. And for myself and my wife and our family, that's basically twice a month. Now I might have a 5-day trip or a 2-day trip or whatever, but basically our travel rule is twice a month. And so I've stuck to that for 15 years. Well, that was a example of mentorship from Steve, because when I was working for him back in the day, he said, Dave, you just need to talk to your wife, figure out what's acceptable for you guys in a family. And then our company will basically honor that. I was like, one, didn't know I should do that. And two, that's really admirable, like super cool. So I was always blessed to have people that would just, you know, take me under their wing and just to say, hey, this is what I've learned. And part of it is, I think, my personality, because I do highly respect and appreciate people that have gone before and what I can learn from them. I'm also the kind of guy that would rather not make my own mistakes. You know, some people are like, I'm going to cut my own, you know, way, and I'm going to figure this out on my own, and I'm going to make my own mistakes or whatever. And I'm like, can you just tell me all the mistakes you've made and I'll just not do those? Like, can I read the book and just, you know, not do those things? Right. Mm-hmm. And that's just, you know, part of my wiring. And so I think that's always been apparent to people who are sort of older and wiser. And so they've invested in me. And then the other one, and I probably quote him once a day, but write, you know, about him once every couple weeks. And that is a gentleman by the name of Bob Beal. Bob, by the way, with 3 B's, B-O-B-B. And Bob, by the way, is a consultant, which I think is so funny, because if you've ever seen the movie Office Space, while we're going in our throwbacks, Bob the consultants were not necessarily appreciated. Yeah. Yeah. And I remember the very first time I met Bob, actually, was at he was consulting with the agency, and somebody canceled on him for lunch or whatever. And so I was I was an account executive at that time. And they were like, hey, Dave, you have time for lunch? Why don't you go with Bob? And I was like, okay, who's Bob? And what does this mean? But it's a free lunch, so I'll take it. And in that lunch, at the end of that lunch, Bob said two things to me. That, by the way, at first were really quite offensive. And I was like, what do you mean, Bob? And ended up being really instrumental in my life. Number one, he said, Dave, you're a salesman. Now one, who wants to be called a salesman? Like, I don't exactly think of that as a generally positive label, right? But two, he didn't realize he was stepping on all sorts of father wounds. Like, my dad thought he was a salesman, but he wasn't a very good one. And, you know, there was just stuff there. And so I was like, you take that back, Bob. Mm-hmm. And he was like, Dave, you've been selling me on ideas this entire lunch. And I was like, oh, touche. Like, if that's what you mean by salesman, you mean like I see something that I want you to see and understand and take advantage of? Like, oh, sign me up. Justin, you and I have known each other long enough that I'm sure you can relate, right? Where it's like, oh yeah, Dave.
Absolutely.
You know, I just feel like I've been blessed with the ability to see certain things. And then I feel like part of my life's mission is to help others see those things. So if that's what a salesman is, then sign me up. The second thing he said, by the way, that was mildly offensive was, Dave, the way you're wired is that you're basically going to be fired up and really good at anything you're working on for about 2 years or 90%. Whichever comes first. And I was like, how do I not see that as a backhanded compliment? Like, are you saying I'm flaky or disloyal? I mean, I had been at the company for 3, 4, 5 years at that point. I can't quite remember, but I was like, I'm not disloyal, Bob. You don't understand. Well, that's not what he meant. It turns out what he meant was my wiring is I am much more entrepreneurial. I prefer to start and to create and to build. But once the thing is pretty much built, like the maintenance or the operationalization or some of those sorts of things was not going to be great for me. And so that one stung a bit, but took a couple weeks to realize, you know what? I actually have not, at that point in my life, I had not worked any job longer than 2 years. And so I was like, well, he could be onto something. Well, again, fast forward 18 years. And now I'm like, okay, I totally see. What it doesn't mean is you're going to quit your job every 2 years or you're flaky or you're inconsistent. What it does mean is I do have this sort of internal clock that I need to pay attention to, that like, okay, Dave, what am I coming up on another one of those seasons? Mm-hmm. And if I don't have something either lined up or sort of on the horizon, then I don't burn out like generally in life. I tend to just sort of rust out like, I guess I'm like lack of fire, lack of passion. And so it's just, it sucks. It's no fun. And
it,
I've been there.
It also explains why chapter 30 of my preview edition is blank, because like it doesn't, the book doesn't end. It got 90%, and then you just, so I don't know.
You lie. There are words there, but actually, we'll talk about the book in a little bit, but there is a reason the entire last section of the book is about the future. Because that was candidly one of the things that made me worried about writing a book in the first place is how could you ever write down like I feel like when you write a book, it feels like it's like final or encapsulated. And it's like, well, what if I'm wrong? What if things change? What if it evolves? Mm-hmm. So actually the last five chapters of the book are about the future, you know, and what things are changing.
So Dave, as you just described, some of your things about your personality and the people you've been influenced by. You said you're not one who likes to take chances, letting other people, you know, you don't want to be the one who makes the mistakes, but then you also get this itch to try new things. Somewhere between those two, how did you make the decision to start your own consulting firm? How did you weigh those?
I love that question. That is, doesn't that seem like such a juxtaposition, like irony of all ironies, you know? Like I don't think of myself as an innovator, by the way. Like some people call me an innovator or Dave's really associated with innovation. And I'm deeply passionate about innovation, but I think of myself as a friend of innovators. Like do you know so-and-so or such-and-such? You know, and I feel like I've learned so much over those, but at the same time, I am by nature a fairly conservative individual. Like, can somebody else go first? You know, like my Apple Watch here, right? By the way, it's a Series 4, so it's super epic old. They're on Series 10 now, I've learned.
Series 4.
Yeah, well done. I'm not going to buy a Series 1. Like, I don't need to be the early adopter, like, you know. So what I'm interested in is when innovation starts to become like to actually make a significant difference in the world. And so a lot of innovation is like very, I don't know if you're familiar with the idea of the hype cycle, right? Innovation, and by the way, I've come to appreciate the hype cycle, that all innovations do need to go through this, what's called the peak of inflated expectations, which totally annoys me, by the way, because you're like, it's not going to, you know, make you breakfast in the morning, like whatever the innovation is. But I've come to appreciate that that's what gets people's attention. But I'm much more interested in, if you follow the hype cycle, by the way, I've just sort of dropped that in there. There's this idea of any new innovation goes through this cycle of the peak of inflated expectations, which is like, it's the best thing ever. It's going to change everything. You know, nothing's going to be the same, you know, crypto, AI, certainly. And then there's the inevitable, what's called the trough of disillusionment, which is like, I guess it isn't all it's cracked up to be, or it turns out there are issues or whatever. I'm interested in the next part of that cycle, which is called the plateau of productivity. Like when you get past the hype and you get into the real, like how is this really making a difference? And so for me, innovation is about helping people to see that, not just about hype, although again, I've learned to appreciate hype. But to me, it's about when is whatever this thing going to make an actual difference in the world, and how can people take advantage of that? You asked the question about starting the company. For me, it was partly that learning that 2-year cycle, and learning that, okay, about every 2 years or so, like if I know I'm coming up on the end of a thing, like I always need to be paying attention to what's next. As I mentioned, Steve at the company was very just gracious, and I never had any job security issues. It was always like, hey, what do you want to do next? You know, like very flexible, super cool that way. Like, honestly, I could not have predicted staying anywhere for 18 years, especially given the 2-year rule, right? But I just always had something next and new and different to tackle, and I loved it. And so I knew in early 20, let's see what happened, that would have been about late 21, 2021. I knew that I was kind of coming towards the next sort of part of that hype cycle, the 2 year sort of situation. And so I knew that I was coming up, and I have started companies before. Obviously, we talked about our skate company. And so that wasn't scary to me. Now, in the mid-career with a mortgage and kids at home and all that kind of stuff, the financial stability was a major question mark. And I had a friend that I was talking to, another mentor coach type of personality in my life. And he said, Dave, you just, because I was debating like, okay, I definitely can go on to whatever the next opportunity is at the agency. But what if I started a thing? Like, I've thought about that. Like, I learned more about myself in terms of my ability to help people see and understand things. And I wanted to invest more time in that. But, and you guys know, when you're running an agency, you know, 96% of my time was helping to run the agency and do all the important things to keep the company moving and growing and all those sorts of things. And I could spend maybe 4% of my time on this kind of thoughtful research, helping people to see and understand things, writing, which I wanted to do more of. And so those two things came together. And this friend of mine said, Dave, you are wired as an entrepreneur. You're either going to scratch that itch and do that at some point, as far as like not an entrepreneur, or you're not. And that's fine. But, you know, just so you know, you're always going to have that itch. And so for me, it was the combination of all those things that said, like, you know what? I think I'm going to do this. Prayed a lot about it, candidly, and just felt like a piece about, okay, I think I'm going to start a thing. I think it's going to look like an advisory practice, so that I can spend 50% of my time helping people to see and understand and think differently. To do what I call sustainable innovation, and then 50% of my time applied to specific organizations and helping them do something. And that was more than 2 years ago now.
Where did the Purpose and Profit podcast with Carly, where did that come into like the tail end of your time at the agency before Imago? That's a little bit of a fun bridge.
It is, and I didn't anticipate it. It makes sense in hindsight, but that preceded starting my own company by 2 years. So we started the podcast in 2020, which, by the way, I saw a stat the other day, I think like 900,000 podcasts were founded in 2020. So we were one of those. And Carly Berna, my co-host, she was at a charity at the time. And she and I had gotten to know each other over the years. And she had candidly for, I think, a year or two prior to that said, Dave, you should do a podcast. And I was like, no, thanks. That sounds like a lot of work. And finally, at one point, I think she texted me, Dave, you know, look at basically that there wasn't any podcast that she felt like were really, you know, serving the space very well at that time. And so she texted me, hey, you should do that podcast. And I said, in a moment of weakness, I said, if you do it with me, I'll do it. And she said, yes. And so in 2020, we started with the Purpose and Profit podcast. We're just finishing up season 5 as we record this, getting ready to launch season 6. And so, but what I told her and what we both felt like is, unless there's a topic that is actually personally just fascinating to she and I, that, you know, classic, if nobody listened, we would still have a good time, then let's not do it. And so for her and I, she was a associate professor, adjunct professor at Pepperdine University, MBA, but also serving in the nonprofit space. So we both had that fascination of like business and brands and causes. And so that was when we were like, what if we like did a show about the like intersection of those two spaces? Like, what could we learn from the world of big brands and business and apply to charities? And then vice versa, what kind of lessons can charities teach businesses? And so then ultimately came up with the idea of Purpose and Profit. And the fun thing, by the way, when we started the podcast, we thought it would be completely two separate worlds. We would be like converging, like, oh, we'll talk to a big business person and then we'll talk to a charity leader. Well, it turns out like 95% of our guests have been on both sides, including, by the way, a certain Justin McCord, who was on the show recently, talking about your background in minor league sports and like how you had to get super creative with a, you know, how to get a major league results with minor league budgets. I thought that was such a fascinating example of a lesson, set of lessons we can learn. Because charities definitely often feel like they have minor league budgets and resourcing. And how do you how do you show up bigger than than maybe your resourcing allows?
The and it is a it's a wonderful lesson. Not the, I mean the episode with me is amazing. Don't get me wrong. The
episode with Justin was incredible. It was just like
I sobbed. I was sobbing. the podcast in general. And Carly, by the way, serial podcaster, I think she has, you know, she has probably 30% of that market share of podcasts started in 2020 that she's co-host of. The Wave Report is your outlet of writing. And I love seeing it hit my inbox. I love right now hearing you tie together some of the things that I observe about your work and hearing, you know, this idea of, you know, sustainable innovation and hearing you share about it. Because, you know, seeing it on screen, reading it is different than hearing the inflection and the passion in your voice. So bridge to us the idea of sustainable giving and why that is a passion or an interest for you, for the space around you.
Yeah, I think, you know, as I mentioned, I do see, I tend to see these trends, and often they're, you know, they can be micro trends, maybe individual lessons that we can learn. And you mentioned the Wave Report, so I'll write an article about it. You know, I was fascinated by in the consumer side, this whole movement towards buy now, pay later services, just as an example, BNPL, they call it in the industry, which incidentally, by the way, this holiday season, end of 2024, was the height of buy now, pay later. So I only use that as an example of like, okay, well, I wonder if that, how that particular consumer trend might eventually impact charitable giving, right? And so I just can't help myself but see, you know, wonder about those sorts of things and to write about them. But every so often there's a topic that is so, not only so massive, but so like title shift for the industry that it's like, it becomes a much bigger deal. And so for me, starting about a decade ago, I started to notice that my own personal consumption habits with regards to subscriptions was completely changing. Like 10 years ago, the only types of recurring transactions I had were basically, you know, power bill, utilities, mortgage payment. Oh, and then child sponsorship, World Vision, Compassion. We sponsored a child when each of our daughters were born. And then I started to, you know, Netflix and then Pandora and, you know, Amazon Prime and like, I started to just feel like, man, subscriptions are like kind of everywhere, right? And then over time, so basically starting about 8 years ago, I started, well, now 10 years ago now, as we record this, started talking about in the industry, like how might the subscription economy transform the way not just people consume, but the way donors give? And will we see donors' comfort level, interest, and expectations around this whole recurring giving thing be shaped by this massive macro trend of the subscription economy? And it's not too different, by the way, guys, from the grandfather of digital jokes, right? Like 2006, it was like, people are learning to open their wallets online and to buy products more than just books, you know, using their quote unquote digital wallets. And so you could just see that tidal wave coming in 2006, which is super fun to ride, to keep the wave metaphor going. And so just, you know, fast forward, over the last 10 years have been speaking about increasingly. And candidly, when I left the company to start my firm, I thought this is a book. Like, I don't know how to write a book. I've written a lot of words in my life, you know, but I feel like this is something that is such an important wave. And it's so tidal that we need to figure out how to make sure that charity leaders understand it. And so for me, it was like, okay, there's 1.5 million nonprofits in the US today. I've done quite a bit of research, especially over the last couple of years writing the book. And my estimate is 75% of nonprofits, guys, have been left out of strong, growing, recurring giving. It's the first charity that I ever worked with 20 years ago, the Union Rescue Mission, right? Where is single digit percentage of their revenue, so much work, but so little fruit. And today, because of the subscription economy and because of the way donors' behaviors and expectations have changed, now represents an opportunity where 10 years ago, this was not an opportunity for 75% of charities. Guys, that's 1.1 million charities that stand to benefit from this. Now, many of those are smaller charities. They're not going to hire Imago Consulting. They're not going to hire RKDE. So part of writing the book was to just be the flag waver in the industry. I am deeply passionate about moving the entire sector forward with regards to sustainable fundraising period, but the chief type of sustainable fundraising is recurring, resilient, recurring giving. And so what can we do to help those 1.1 million nonprofits and get that word out?
There's so much truth in it, and it's why I'm super excited about the book itself. It's heavier than I wanted it to be.
I have been told by some that I'm verbose. The good news is, and I don't even think I should tell you the, by the way, it's, you know, it's normal. I've been told, by the way, that a typical business book is 40 to 60,000 words, and it's just under the upper limit.
Okay. All right. Now I'm excited about it. We're excited about the work that you're doing on it. Because we see eye to eye. It is a title shift. It's not the only title shift, but it is a major title shift right now. And the opportunity is too important to pass up. You know, you referenced just, you know, being at the outset of digital generation one. And there are a fair number of nonprofits in the US today that are still working in digital generation one.
Yeah.
And you know, I don't know if you would consider this to be the start of Gen 4, but it's something that the accessibility is there. Like I think the slope into digital generation one was pretty seismic for people mentally to wrap their minds around. Okay, what does it look like to build a website? What does it look like to build an online donation form? What does it look like to regularly communicate through these things? And how do you not make it just brochureware? And then you go into, you know, Gen 2 of probably the rise of email, and then Gen 3 of the mobile transformation. I'm making all of these things up. You probably have written 13,000 words about these various generations. But then Gen 4 being, okay, well, how do you create it so that it is sustainable and that you're meeting people in a new way? And the accessibility for that, it's probably the most accessible of the previous generations compared to the previous generations.
Yeah. And you know, the reason I use the title wave metaphor is not just because that's a cool metaphor and often used with innovation, but because there is an element, and I have studied plenty of surfing. I'm a much more personally failed surfer, by the way. So when I talk about the wave report, this is all the lessons I've learned from all the things I've done wrong trying to surf as a Southern California native. But one of the lessons you learn in surfing is that go with the wave. Like, so much of when I was an amateur trying to learn how to surf was like paddling, you know, too early or paddling too late or not getting pointed in the right direction. And so the cool thing is when there's already a wave and you can catch that momentum, it's so much easier. That's why I don't buy Apple Series Watch 1, right? Because that's not a wave yet. Like, you know, a few generations in, it's going to be, there's going to be momentum. There's going to be, you know, quality there. And so the way you said it with accessibility is totally right. Recurring giving has been around, by the way, for thousands of years. I have a chapter in the book, short one, for those of you that are not history buffs, but that does trace the brief history of sustainable giving. And it goes back thousands of years to the ancient Jewish people, by the way, and their whole practice of first fruits and bringing their crops, you know, to the temple. But then the temple would then distribute, you know, the proceeds to the poor and the widows. Sounds like charity to me. And so it's not new, but over the last 10 years, the subscription economy has changed, again, the way donors engage, but it's also created this momentum that we can catch. And so that's why, you know, when I call it the rise of sustainable giving, that's what I'm trying to say is, guys, this is not new, but there is something different about this, and you can take advantage of it. Recurring giving is more available to more charities than at any other time in history. And that is not an exaggeration. Like, that is the reality that we're living in today. And so that's what I wanted charity leaders, particularly in North America, candidly, to hear and to see. And then how to take advantage of it. Hence the reason the book's so long, by the way. The book could be as half as long as I just...
it's not so long. Stop. Would you stop being self-conscious?
Thankfully, the chapters, by the way, for those that are like intimidated now, the chapters are like 10 pages each, maybe. But the you know, half of the book is literally how to build and grow a thriving recurring giving program, because I didn't just want to wave the flag, so to speak, of recurring giving, but I also wanted to literally just give a practical how-to guide. So
yeah. And some of the chapters like fold out into multiple pages. And so that's kind of a cool party trick that you built into. I'm going to keep messing with you about it because I know that it
false advertising, but
yeah.
There's a super cool, we do have a super cool online assessment. That is actually, yes. I'm very proud of that. 25 questions, 7 minutes, gives you a total read on how your recurring giving program is at a high level. So it gives you a sampler of the ideas in the book, which I think is super helpful. We've put together, in fact, by the time this episode airs, we'll have out a blueprint, 7-step blueprint for growing a recurring giving program. So lots of good stuff. Those are the free ones. So that's easy.
That's awesome. Fun. It's so cool. Well, a special preview edition of our congratulations to you on the successful launch of it, because we're excited to see it out into the ether and to see your work continue and to get to hang with you in one of those 2 trips a month and all of those things. So, thanks for leaning in, and thanks for spending time today telling us a little bit about how you got here and why you got here. It's fun for us.
Well, and it's a gift for me. You know, I love the format that you guys have, and just really delving deeper right into the backstory. So it's a gift to me.
Oh, B-side Ronnie, he's going to come up with the best questions off the beaten path, man.
I love it.
Yeah. All right, man. We'll catch up later. We'll catch up down the road.
Good stuff. Glad to be on here.
Group Thinkers is a production of RKD Group. For more information, including how you can partner with RKD to accelerate growth for your fundraising and nonprofit marketing needs, visit rkdgroup.com.